Hey, it's John Moe here. Just before we start, I wanted to make sure you knew that we now have official Depression Mode merchandise. And the very first merch item we're carrying is sweatpants. We thought it was appropriate. They're beautiful sweatpants. They have the name and logo of the show printed on them. They're comfy. They're comfy for lounging around the house or for getting out and exercising. Whichever one you want to do, we won't judge. That's up to you. They're your pants. You can find a link to those pants, to a place where you can buy those pants at our show page on Maximum Fun, or you could find them on our Twitter page at DepreshPod, or you can find them on the Preshies Facebook group. Lots of ways to find those Depresh Mode pants. Okay, now for the show. The Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur. You know them. First controlled, sustained flight of a powered, heavier-than-air aircraft on December 17th, 1903, happened just south of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And that flight happened after many years of struggling through research, taking big gambles, having ideas, but not always the knowledge of how to execute them, until they figured that out with a plane called the Wright Flyer, W-R-I-G-H-T, Flyer. It was a big deal. You have heard about it. You know about them and their flyer and Kitty Hawk. You might not know that in 1904, a year later, they tested the Wright Flyer II. Now, they couldn't afford to go back to Kitty Hawk this time, Orville and Wilbur, so this took place near Dayton, Ohio, where they live. And at first, the Wright Flyer II was, well, you know how sequels are sometimes. Engine troubles, no winds to help it along. It kept failing and breaking, but they got it going. And then followed years of trying to secure more funding, to fly more, trying to secure government contracts. The Wright brothers went to France to drum up support because aviation interest was really high there, but the brothers had been regarded as what the French call bluffeurs or bluffers. People didn't believe in them. They had to go to France to convince the French that they weren't bluffeurs. There were patent disputes, more crashes and injuries. Eventual success, though. Finally, it took a long time. Perhaps you've flown in an airplane yourself. You know that this thing really caught on. The point is, it was very hard to get the plane flying in the first place. And then it was very hard to make airplanes a regular, dependable thing. It's all a lot of work. Even after the breakthrough, there's still so much work to be done. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. A lot of people are like Orville and Wilbur Wright. You put a hell of a lot of work into figuring out who you are, getting your self-knowledge flying, but then you have to put in more work to do what's next. It's a two-parter. We all have to win over our own versions of the French to convince someone in our life that we are not bluffeurs. Convince the French that are inside our own minds. That's a sentence I've never said before. Bridger Weiniger is a successful comedy professional. He's a writer, producer, actor with television credits including Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Black Monday, Single Parents. He's worked on several late-night shows. Bridger has earned a ton of fans on Twitter and then quit Twitter. More on that later. And he's the host of the podcast I Said No Gifts, where he interviews guests who bring him gifts despite his coy insistence that they should not do so. It's a bit. It's funny. His guest here is Georgia Hardstark from My Favorite Murder.
The other day, you left something on my porch.
I know. I'm so sorry. Please don't be mad.
Okay, I won't be mad. I'll hold off on that. I'll try to tamp down my natural temper. You dropped something off that appears to be a gift.
Yes.
Georgia, you know, we have a complicated relationship. I'm essentially, we're friends. I'm also essentially your employee. This feels like a compromised situation. But right. Is this a gift for me?
It's for you.
I feel like I've been doing a bad job of getting the rapping audio recently, so we're going to really live it up.
Oh, yeah, that ASMR. Yeah.
Do it. Oh. Oh, this is beautiful.
It's cute, right?
Utah shot glass with all of these different Utah. You've got the Bryce Canyon National Park, the Zion National Park.
Bridger Weiniger getting to the big leagues of comedy is his Wright Flyer taking to the air? I talk to him now that he's in his Wright Flyer 2 phase, his conquering French skepticism era. That's where he is today. Bridger Weiniger grew up Mormon in Utah.
Outside of Salt Lake City, a suburb known as South Jordan, I grew up. It's maybe 15 or 20 minutes from Salt Lake City.
Many years ago, I would travel through Utah doing touring theater. And I recall that theater and performance and musicals, big, big, big deal among the Mormons of Utah.
Mormons love live theater.
Yeah.
And it seems to only grow in popularity there. There's a massive new theater that they've built just in the last few years. It's, I think, just local stuff, but they put on a big production. I don't know what the connection between Mormonism and seeing. I think maybe because a lot of the musicals that are really popular are more of the old-fashioned ones that kind of harken back to old-fashioned values and that kind of thing. I think that connection might, and it's like kind of wholesome entertainment.
Not a lot of Hedwig and the Angry Inch productions in Provo.
Right, right. You're not going to be seeing that in Sandy, Utah. But you might see Seven Brides for Seven Brothers or
right.
This kind of thing.
Were you like that? Did you grow up as a performer?
Weirdly, like in elementary school, it was something I was really excited about. And I loved making people laugh and... In fifth grade, I was like in the school, two school plays. I had such a good time. And then there were never really any opportunities, performance after that. I mean, I was in a ballroom dance troupe in middle school. And then once I got to high school, I think who I was, which I didn't really embrace until much later, but like I started to like kind of bump up against kind of the corniness or kind of the old-fashioned sort of thing that we're talking about with the theater in Utah. And that was kind of the high school theater scene. So that didn't really appeal to me. And so there was really no outlet for me to perform outside of like, we would hold assemblies at the school and I was in student government. So I could kind of like produce shows. Like I remember hosting a dating game show and like getting to make videos for that kind of thing. But it was really limited. I didn't have a lot of places that I could actually perform.
Yeah, it wasn't a big showbiz calling that that you were heading for. Well, so then did the depression that you alluded to, sounds like it's been very strong for a long time. When did that first show up?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, I've always, it's such an interesting thing for me because it, in a lot of ways, is very situational, but also I was clinically diagnosed when I was 20, but it like kind of all goes together with my various anxiety issues and social anxiety. But like officially the first time I was like able to be like somebody else pointed it out was when I was 20.
Okay. Were you in college at that time?
So basically what happened was I went on a Mormon mission when I was 19. And those are supposed to last 2 years. At the time, I was in East Malaysia. I had been there for about 4 months, and I had gone on this thing essentially out of cultural pressure. When you grow up male in Utah, it's kind of a given that you're going to be going on a Mormon mission when you turn 19.
Yeah, it's expected.
Right, yeah. And so I had gone... Still not entirely sold on the religion, hoping that it would kind of just wash over me and become my thing. I at the time was literally a decade away from coming out of the closet. So there were a lot of things going on in my mind, but I went on this mission. It's extremely hard work. It's, you know, you're on a bike for like 8 hours a day. In East Malaysia, it's like 90 degrees, 1,000% humidity. And if you're not sold on what you're selling, it can be crushing. And you also have one other person, your mission companion, to talk to. This guy was terrible. So I really had no one to talk to. And I was starting my various mental things that I still deal with now were really manifesting themselves for the first time. And there was this enormous pressure back from back home that was like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I had a nervous breakdown, like a literal nervous breakdown.
In Malaysia. And what did that consist of? Walk us through that, because that's a term a lot of people have heard, but maybe right. don't understand what it's like to be in the middle of.
Yeah, and this is actually not something I've ever really talked about to anyone outside of that situation and my family and stuff. And I'm actually fine talking about it now. At the time, it's so crazy to look back on, because I ended up swallowing like a bunch of Advil, like a bottle of Advil. In my Mormon mind at the time, I thought this will either kill me. Basically, what is going to happen is I'm going to kill myself, or it will be bad enough that I'll get to go home. And despite the fact that going home also sounds like social death to me, because there's a huge stigma about returning home from your mission early there. But at the time, I was like, both of those seem, I would prefer either of those to my current situation. So thankfully, I mean, I obviously had not really put myself in that much danger. I mean, I can't say for sure what the actual danger was going to be, but it was enough for them, the people in charge of the mission, to be like, okay, so now you can either go home, or we can send you to essentially a mental hospital in Singapore until you've dealt with this issue, until we've got you back on track, and then you can stay on the mission. And at the time, I was like, well, no, I'm not doing that. That sounds even darker than what I'm currently going through. I'll go home. So what is the point I'm trying to make? That's basically what happened. It was this big, dramatic, crazy thing, which I'm really thankful happened now, because going home was horrible. Fortunately, my family was very supportive. They were obviously very concerned about my mental health and my well-being. My parents are very supportive, and people around me were supportive, but it was this thing of like, you go back and you feel like something's wrong with you. I mean, like, you feel like people are looking at you differently.
Yeah. It's like the military, I imagine, you know, like right. a dishonorable discharge or something.
Totally. It's 100% that sort of feeling. But I did go home, and that's when I was set up kind of for the first time with a therapist, and was diagnosed with some level of depression. I was put on Prozac. And then there was a lot of weird stuff I was dealing with, where it was like, in the Mormon church, like, neighborhoods are basically broken up, and they're called wards, and you have, like, you're the leader of that ward is called the bishop. And my bishop was like, kind of equated depression with basically saying like, this could be Satan, basically, which was
wow.
one of the first real red flag. I mean, like, major waving red flags religiously for me, where I was like, that is such a medieval thought.
Yeah. I was going to ask what's the idea in the church of getting diagnosed with depression, getting on Prozac, getting that kind of treatment. Is that a common thing?
It is. I think it's more and more common that the Mormon church, despite being very old fashioned in countless ways, in other ways is like, can be moderate. And I think that therapy and mental health are now not as looked down upon or like thought of as things that you shouldn't deal with. I think that they're encouraged. And at the time, I think it was something that the church supported or whatever, but like, just in this particular circumstance, this particular leader was like,
that's Satan.
Just had a real fucked up idea of the whole situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So about what year was that?
I want to say this was 2004.
Okay.
2005, maybe?
A while ago, but not all that long ago.
No, within modern times.
Yes, in the current century.
Yeah, yes.
So, I mean, was the break that you had, was that, you know, an attempt and that kind of collapse that you had, as far as you can understand it now, Was it a buildup of depression and anxiety and this untenable situation? Did it have to do with your sexuality that you, you know, maybe were feeling but couldn't come to grips with?
Yeah, I mean, definitely in a weird way, because it was years and years before I even came out to myself. So like the idea when I was 19 or 20, like in my own head that I was gay was like just like so far from, it was like I at the time definitely knew I had those feelings and was attracted to men and had known that for years, but like I was able to somehow push that aside, and it was like I just haven't dated women yet, so this is just something that probably everyone deals with. It's not and even at the time I recognized other gay people were real and that it was a real thing, but for my own self, I had never really met another gay person. It just didn't seem like my own reality. So I think that weird thing that my brain was going through, pushing all that aside, was, I'm sure, contributed to it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and in my suburb, like, you know, our block was probably 50% Mormon. It was a very strong Mormon kind of community. And what always struck me is that there was doctrine, and then there was a lot of negotiation kind of within that doctrine, you know, and right. there were the people who, even among the kids, there were the kids who followed everything to the letter and tried to recruit me to join the church. And then there were the teenage girls who were Mormon and were getting pregnant. You know, right. it was kind of, and it was sort of hard to read what the rules were going to be. And then I know, you know, in later years, I've read about a gay Mormon men who are out as gay, but then say, but, you know, I'm devoted to my faith, so I will never do anything about it. I will never have a relationship. I will never be sexual. And I just go, huh.
Yes, I've had that reaction to that sort of thing as well. And long before I even left the religion, I remember being like, reading, I think it was like a church published article by one such person that was like, I'm gay, but I've pushed it aside and made a family and lived with my wife for years. And I just remember thinking, I don't know what that logic is. And that feels wild to me.
So what was the sequence in which you figured out your mental health, left the church, came out? Because it seems like a long road to get to the Bridger that we that we know from television and podcasting and other media now.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long, slow, like laser beam alarm climbing over Catherine Zeta style thing that I went through.
More with Bridger Weiniger just ahead, including getting famous on Twitter and then quitting Twitter. As we go to break, here's where I first saw Bridger on the very delightful Netflix sitcom Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt as a SWAT team member brought in to deal with a tense situation.
Send in a saucy gay friend for her to get real with. Go, go, go!
Let it out, girl!
This must be Kimmy.
You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized
for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Back with Bridger Weiniger. We're trying to trace the route from self-denying, closeted, gay young Mormon in Utah with serious depression and a mental breakdown in his back pocket to successful LA comedy guy.
Okay, so I think it basically started with me coming home from the mission. I'm 20 or whatever. It took me a long time to graduate from college, but being diagnosed with depression, recognizing all of that, but at the same time, and also starting to come to terms with my sexuality, but knowing that I could not ever embrace it in any way. So it was like, or at least in the idea that I was going to be living in Utah. Like, I thought, if I'm going to be living in Utah for the rest of my life, being gay is not going to ever be on the table for me. I will have to figure something else out. So I had always wanted to work in comedy, but it felt like it felt like something other people got to do. I didn't, obviously, growing up in Utah, you don't really know a lot of people in the biz, but I was, the tail end of college, I was able to get an internship at Letterman. And that was the first little grain of hope that, like, oh, maybe I can break out of any of this. Maybe there's a glimmer of hope of working in entertainment, which may allow me to support myself in a community outside of Utah, which, and then maybe I'll be able to come out.
So mid-20s at this point, mid to late
20s? Yeah, I think it was like 24 or something when I got that internship.
Mid-20s. Yeah.
23, something like that. Went and did the internship, came back to Utah, worked for a while. Of course, like, told everyone, oh, I'm going to move to New York or LA. Didn't do anything about it because it was so daunting. But Twitter came along and it was the first thing where I was like, oh, I can write jokes on here and meet other comedy people. So I slowly started doing that. Maybe a year or so later, moved to LA with no anything. And at this point, had like basically stopped going to church. Like, it had been maybe a year or two that I had completely stopped going to church. And had even admitted to my mom. She had like come to me and been like, do you believe in this? And I was like, I don't. So that felt like a giant thing. But then I moved to LA. I think I was 24, 25. I came out here, worked a terrible PA job for years that led nowhere. But I was meeting people through Twitter. And 4.5 years in, I would say, I was like, okay, well, I've given this a shot. It's not working out. Started looking up like social media jobs in Utah again. And about a month later, Jimmy Kimmel reached out to me and over the course of a month or so offered me a job to write. And that was, I mean, that completely, literally, I mean,
discovering you on Twitter?
Yeah. And he basically saved my life, because up until that point, coming out was not an option, because I was like, if I do, I don't know that I can support myself. I may have to go back to Utah. I don't know how my family's going to react to that, and I need them as some sort of fallback.
Support, sure.
Yeah, and so he came along, gave me this ability to support myself, and that was the first time where I had a little bit of courage to be like, oh, maybe this is going to work out in some fashion. Maybe I can plant my roots here and start to approach this life that truly felt like an unachievable dream of coming out and this sort of thing. And then, you know, like maybe 6 months later, I met my current boyfriend, maybe a little bit longer than that. And now things have kind of rolled along. But I still deal with all of, I mean, still deal with my mental health issues galore, but at least was able to drop that weight.
So it sounds like you're in these kind of, you know, you're pursuing your dream, which is great. You're getting affiliated with some late night shows and people are believing in you, but shit, some pretty high stakes, you know, some pretty existential high stakes. How is your depression holding up, like through going to Letterman, returning from Letterman, going to LA without all that much of a plan? How is your depression?
It was constant. I will say it was constant. It was basically every day. I'm not medicated right now, and I'm like trying to figure that all out. I'm in therapy with a new therapist, and we're like slowly going through some things. And I'm trying to separate what I'm dealing with biologically with what I've been dealing with just in my actual life for the last few decades. And it's hard to parse sometimes where it's like, I've been out for 6.5 years and I'm still finding things like, oh, the reason I do whatever is because I just never learned how to do anything. I had been hiding things for 30 years. I feel like I'm still thawing out. But yeah, my depression through all of those things was like a pretty constant hum. The anxiety was the thing that was up and down, where it was like, I mean, when, I guess the strongest example is when I first got that job at Kimmel, and it felt like this lifeline and this thing that was like, oh, here's the thing. The thing about those jobs is they're 13-week cycles, which people frequently get dropped after 13 weeks. So when I got hired for the first time, my anxiety was just astronomical. I mean, like, truly, there were so many sleepless nights, and then there was the trying to figure out how to fall asleep, you know, like trying things like antihistamines, which actually I learned I have. There's something called the paradoxical effect with medicine, which is like it does the opposite of what you're supposed to do.
Yep.
And so there were like days that I would be awake for like 2 to 3 days because I would take these things thinking, oh, it's going to help me fall asleep. And instead, it was basically like I was on speed, which is not a great feeling when you're already anxious and worrying that you're going to lose your job and that this is your last chance at the life you want to have.
And then in that state, you have to come up with some really charming comedy bits.
Right. And you also have to act totally cool, like it's not a big deal, yeah, and you know how to do this.
Wow. And I read where Jimmy Kimmel, when you were ready to finally come out to your parents, offered to fly out to Utah and help them through it.
Jimmy feels like my honorary uncle. He through the whole process was so supportive and welcoming and was kind of and it's weird because he, you know, like has up until the last few years had a very strong bro-y image, like this man's man guy. And so like coming out there, I was even a little frightened despite it being a lovely workplace and very supportive, but it was like,
it's got the snapping towel kind of idea about it, historically.
Right. That's kind of what I expected, and it was not that at all. I think that I knew it was okay because I was never an excellent fit for that show because I feel like my sensibility is just a little maybe strange or dark, and Jimmy was still, I would pitch weird things, and he was really supportive of them. So I knew that, like, he appreciated that about me, and, like, I knew that there was room to be myself there, despite assumptions that a lot of people have about it.
I mean, it's funny because when I've heard your name kind of in the ether for many years, and I also thought, oh, well, yeah, that's that kind of iconoclastic figure. Like, everyone knows he's a genius, but nobody knows all that much about him. You know, you had kind of like, you know, semi-mystical quality about you. But, and yeah, I could have just read more and probably found out things. But had you ever thought of embracing just this unusual background you have and embracing the kind of scars that you got from the religion and from the mission and from the Advil and from everything else is like, you know, I have something more to say than somebody who's just been brought up the comedy ranks in the traditional way.
Yeah. I mean, I think about that sort of thing all the time. And it's such a weird thing because I felt like I've embraced so much of who I am and have been able to live such a full life in the last, I don't even know how many years, 7-ish years, I guess, at this point. But I'm still like, even up until the last year and a half, I think I now host this other podcast and like the being forced to just like, oh, I have to talk on a thing once a week has been the first time that I've like really been able to, or have kind of just been pushed out to talk about my personal life and this kind of thing. Because up until then, I was able to keep a very tight lid on all of it. My Twitter had almost nothing to do with who I actually was. It was like a picture of me that was like a joke picture where I basically looked like a woman that just got out of prison or something. I mean, like a lot of people thought I was a woman on Twitter. Like I remember the Huffington Post putting me like on funny tweets from women this week.
Women to watch.
Right. And I mean, all of that obviously or partially comes from being closeted for a long time and not feeling comfortable about sharing anything about myself. Like my Instagram feed is just kind of pictures of garbage or bad, like badly shot photos. It's like has nothing to do with me. So it's only been in the last year and a half that I've been comfortable talking about a lot of this stuff. So I'm like, I would like to obviously write, you know, the dumb, like write what you know. And I think that there is interesting stuff there, but I'm still like figuring out how to make it funny the way I would like it to be funny, but also the stakes feel very high for me because it is extremely personal and I don't want to churn out something that doesn't reflect my experience in an interesting, funny way. And I do feel like a lot of great TV shows and entertainment right now are from people's really personal experiences, but they're more drama than they are comedy. And something that I'm constantly fighting to try to do is make things funny. And if I'm going to do something like that, I want it to make people laugh.
That's the important part.
Which is so, so difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, yeah. I mean, to me, the idea of writing something and believing that this will be the thing that makes people laugh the most is like predicting the weather in 5 years, you know?
Oh, 100%.
It's so hard.
And terrifying.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of like stage performance, stand-up, kind of in front of live audience stuff?
Live audience stuff, I don't do much of that at all. I've acted in TV shows a little bit and on camera, which I love doing because I know if I fail, we can just try again. Live performance continues to, I mean, I've definitely gotten more comfortable with it, but I think just the nature of how I got into the business at all through just writing jokes on Twitter, which led to me writing on TV shows has been more of that. But now with like the podcast, I'm just getting comfortable talking in front without the safety net of like, oh, we can do it again.
Yeah. Well, so your podcast, No Gifts, Please, you know, it has that lovely photo of you on the tile. And it's funny to me because the premise that you're inviting people and they're not supposed to bring gifts, but oh my gosh, they did. And that picture and Amy Mann's theme song is delightful. And I kind of have the episodes I've listened to, I go in expecting something very campy, expecting something kind of silly, and it's not. It's very charming and
well, that's very sweet.
Is it a character you're playing? Is it, you know, a conscious side of yourself that you're trying to put out there in that format?
The podcast, it's like it's a weird thing for me because when I had the initial idea, it was like it'll be a fun chat show. It gives each guest like an easy conversation piece that they can bring. They can talk about whatever they want. I'm excited about that.
And you're so polite because you didn't correct me when I got the name of the podcast wrong, which is No Gifts, not No Gifts, Please.
It's okay. I don't care. but I had the idea of it and I was frustrated with, I would listen to other podcasts and like, I'd be like, oh, I love that person. I want to hear a conversation with them. And frequently I'd feel like either you didn't get to have fun listening to them because the host was trying to keep up or be as cool as the guest or be as funny as the guest. Or, you know, there were just various things where I was like, I would love to have a podcast where there's a nice, simple premise. It's clear that it's going to be a fun time. It's going to be a nice time. And we can just be silly with each other. And it's so for the most part, I think on the show, I do play a little bit slightly heightened version of who I am. I feel like I basically am being who I want to be at a party, which okay. is like somebody who can make nice small talk and get into make people laugh. And then like maybe halfway through the podcast, when the gimmick of it, like the person bringing the gift comes on, I feel like there's a little bit of artifice where like I love comedy to the point when something's done to the point of irritation or being annoying. So like I like that there is a thing that if someone listens for multiple episodes, they know that there's going to be this annoying thing that I'm going to talk about. I acted like I didn't want a gift. We're going to get into a little bit of drama there. Mm-hmm. Some guests like will come on and we get to do a nice improv about all of that. Some guests just want to talk about the thing they brought it, but it's just all very low stakes, nice time. I like a nice time. I also, going back to why I wanted to do the podcast in the first place was I felt like so many podcasts are done by extremely loud men. And I wanted something. I was like, if I were to listen to a podcast, I would want nice voices, people talking at room level and not trying to out loud each other.
Yeah, right. Not try to top the bit that the other one is doing.
Right.
When you say the joke that gets repeated to the point of annoyance, are you talking about that it's week after week and that you're just fully committing to it, or the joke within the section that's being repeated over and over?
I'll say I think both, actually. I mean, going back to like my Instagram I started in 2013. It's essentially just photos of garbage with captions written by someone who thinks they've taken a good photo. And at the time I was like, oh, I'll probably do this for 6 months and burn out. And now I've been doing it for, I think, 8 years and it does. But there's a little bit of, I still get a little spark of being like, oh, I can't believe I'm doing another one of these things. I just love like, I guess, bothering people.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently took my middle child to college for her to start her college career.
Oh, and
it was wonderful. And while we were moving her in, my joke was to tell my family, my wife and my other kids, because we were all there. I would say, everybody here thinks I'm a student. And I'm 53. Nobody thinks I'm a student. And like somebody would ask me like what time it was. And I'm like, oh, it's 3:15. They're asking me because they think I'm a student too. They're probably wondering what my major is. And my family laughed at it at the beginning, then laughed a little bit less, and then just hated me for like a couple of days. And then on the way out of town, I just committed to the bit all over again and brought it back around to the point of funny. And
yeah, I completely support that. Like nothing makes me feel better than when I've done something to the point when someone just says, oh, Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. Here he goes.
Right.
More with Bridger Weinegaard just ahead.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travell Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification? We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
Hi. It's me, Dave Hill, from before, here to tell you about my brand new show on Maximum Fun, the Dave Hill Good Time Hour, which combines my old Maximum Fun show, Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, with my old radio show, The Goddamn Dave Hill Show, into one new futuristic program from the future. If you like delightful conversation with incredible guests, technical difficulties, and actual phone calls from real-life listeners, you've just hit a street called easy. I'm also joined by my incredible co-host, the boy criminal Chris Gersbeck. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, Dave. It's really great
That's enough, Chris. And New Jersey chicken rancher, Dez. Say hi, Dez.
Hey, Dave.
The Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Brand new episodes every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Plus, the show's not even an hour. It's 90 minutes.
Take that, stupid rules.
We nailed it.
We're back with writer, producer, and podcast host Bridger Weinegar. You got noticed on Twitter, and it's interesting to me that you are out there on Twitter talking, it sounds like, pretty honestly about your depression, but also in comedy circles, you know, tweeting about how horrible everything is and how I'm miserable, you know, is as old as comedy itself, like that kind of self-deprecating thing. So it's, I bet a lot of people thought you were just kidding when you were laying your heart out there.
Absolutely. I mean, I won't even say that I was laying my, I was making what probably, you know, Twitter or whatever, these services now have, like, they'll send you a warning or they'll lock your account if you're, like, talking about things that, like, self-harm or whatever, which is great. But, you know, there was a time when I was pretty frequently talking about wanting to be dead or wanting, or, like, ideas about, you know, like, killing myself or whatever. Which I was finding fun ways to say them, but they were coming from very real places. And but then I was, you know, it was kind of out of like a, I need to do this to get a job in this business. This is a funny way of saying it. I'm being rewarded because people are liking it or whatever. It's leading to me getting a following. So it was this weird, just
economy,
complicated,
you know, yeah, it's like currency about it.
Right. In a lot of ways, should not have been encouraged to be broadcasting that sort of thought in such a, I don't know. I also think that, sure, I love dark humor and that sort of thing, but it was just a weird thing of being like, oh, I'm being rewarded for having these real thoughts and making them seem like a joke when they're not a joke. And now no one knows if I'm actually in trouble or not.
Were people reaching out to you and seeing how you're
doing? No. I mean, I have one good friend who we met through Twitter in maybe 2011 or whatever, who I think kept tabs on me. He's one of the sweetest people in the world and really was encouraged me through a lot of stuff and like was aware of this sort of tweeting going on. But he also knew me personally, and he was probably the one person that I was able to kind of like talk about how depressed I was to. So, but otherwise, I don't think anybody really knew. I think that, you know, because I do think that there was like a kind of a wave of Twitter and social media of like wearing anxiety or depression as a costume to make jokes or whatever.
Yeah. To see how more, if you can be more morbid than the other fella.
Right. And that, I mean, it's obviously, that's a very hard thing to tell who's authentically depressed and who's chasing likes or whatever.
Well, that's where I come in, Bridger.
That's John Moe is a fraud.
That's my niche within the comedy community. I can do that detective work for it. I should rent myself out. You mentioned when we first started talking that you're done with Twitter, taking a break from Twitter for your mental health.
I'm done with it. I use it, I mean, diminishing returns to promote my own podcast. I'll get on every Thursday and be like, I know none of you are here for my podcast. You were never here for my podcast, but just in case, you can click this link and then I'm out. Because I mean, I should have done it much sooner, but it's a well-documented addictive service. I also like writing jokes, but especially the last few years, it's just become a really brutal place to be. It's just like taking on a million different types of weights every day that you don't necessarily have to, and combine that with like also wanting to perform for people and make people laugh. And so that can play into you know, feeling bad about yourself if a joke doesn't land or whatever. And then just like you get on there and you're like, oh, I have to be worried about everything in every way. And I have to know about every single thing. And I admire people that have the strength to do that. But like, especially with the pandemic, I think it was the final straw where I was just like, I need to take at least one thing off of my plate that is causing me to worry.
Is it the reading that was getting to you more than the writing on Twitter?
It was both. I mean, obviously the reading, like even when I get on now to like post about my podcast, it's like, oh my God, look at all these horrible things happening. And I'm not worried enough about a lot of these things and I don't know what to do. So it's like peeking into the Ark of the Covenant for a split second or something. It's just like, oh my God, the shrieking nightmare. So that definitely, especially through the Trump years, just every single minute there was some horrible thing that was going on that just made you feel sick to your stomach. And not, a lot of that has not gone away. The world continues to feel like it's designed to make us all sad at all times. Yeah, and then like the writing of it still felt very high pressure. It's like, here's a new joke that you can all look at, and if it's not good, I'm going to feel extremely bad about myself and feel that horrible. It's like cutting, you know? It's just like...
Yeah, it's quantitative. Like, oh, that got that number, but that other one got that number.
Well, and it's also, for me personally, like something that I have, when I was writing jokes on Twitter, I would have to remind myself, oh, most of the things that I find funny on this website, which are very few and far between, usually don't perform that well. They don't have 50,000 retweets and 100,000 likes. They're like, they might get 100 because they're strange thoughts that like most people, they don't really... But it's hard, it's like easy to say that to yourself and then you tweet something and it gets 100 likes or whatever and you're like, oh, I'm a failure and I'm not funny and my career is over. So yeah, removing it has, I think, been largely been beneficial. There are things I miss writing jokes in that way. I miss thinking about thoughts, but thinking about thoughts, what am I saying?
I miss thinking about thoughts as well.
I miss like trying to observe things or try to, I mean, I obviously, I am very lucky I get to write for a living. And so I do have other outlets for that, but that part is missing. I'm trying to be conscious of like, oh, I should stay up to date on the world. It is important to like, to be aware of what's going on politically and socially and all of these things. But I'm trying to find a more moderate intake of that that doesn't feel like I'm showing up and having just cinder blocks dropped on me every morning.
It's hard to sip from a fire hose.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. How's your mental health today as we speak?
It's varies day to day. I've been seeing a new therapist, which of course is always such a struggle to even find a therapist. But for the last few months, and it's, you know, I feel like he's been very helpful in my life. The last year has been it might be news to you. It's been the last year and a half has been difficult for people.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
But
heard that a couple of places.
Having that much time for my brain to wander this last year has been basically like I haven't felt this bad since before I came out. And so, especially when I wasn't working. And so I'm at least happy I've got this podcast to occupy a little bit of my brain power. I now have this job that I've been working on for about a month or so. And I have a therapist who is helping me deal with things. And I have a very supportive boyfriend. So I feel good. There are times that are very dark, but I at least the nice thing when thoughts get so dark that they feel out of place, I'm at least able to a lot of the time recognize them and be like, oh, that is not how I normally think. Obviously, things are happening in my brain. And obviously, it takes a decent amount of digging to get out of it. But I at least now feel like I can like at least see the darkness coming or around me and kind of push away from it rather than just letting it take over me.
Are you able to spot the distortions? Like when the depression thinking comes along, are you able to say, hold on, I know what's happening.
I'm getting much, much better at it. I mean, obviously when there's a distortion, your brain thinks it's real. So it's like learning to be like, to just take a second and be like, is that based anywhere in reality? Or is this just one of my beautiful nightmares that my brain has decided is what's actually happening when it's not?
A couple of short questions here. When you were on Twitter and writing about your depression in an honest way, and maybe some people were thinking of it as a joke and you were really laying it all out, were you in therapy at that time, or was that your only form of therapy?
That was I did not start seeing a real therapist. I mean, I saw a therapist in Utah when I was in my early 20s, but that was kind of tied into the Mormon church, and I don't really count that quite as therapy. I didn't start seeing a therapist until 2018.
Oh, wow.
I then had a couple therapists in between, and I'm now with my current guy, and it is one of these things. It's like finding a good therapist is, I have decent insurance, I live in a major city, and it's still unbelievably difficult to find good mental health. And so it's just such a, I mean, again, this is not news, but the mental health system in this country, I can't imagine somebody like, I don't know. It's frustrating to think that there are people that are having an even harder time.
Yeah, it's the hardest for people who need it the most.
It's ridiculous.
Which is so sinister.
Yeah.
How did you get Amy Mann to do the theme song for your show?
She's the best, just the absolute best person in the world.
Yes, I know this.
My boyfriend and I were at our friend has like a movie night, and she was there, and Amy and I followed each other on Twitter, but we didn't know each other. My boyfriend was like, from across the room, he's like, is that Amy Mann? And this was years ago. And I was like, yes, leave her alone. And he has a very different personality than me. He's a boisterous person from New Jersey. So he just went up to her, what I should say is he has like healthy social habits. He just went up and introduced himself and said that he, you know, whatever. I reluctantly came along. We met her, and we've now just become good friends. And so when this podcast came around and we needed a theme song, I was like, I doubt she's going to do it. I mean, she's literally a legend, but I guess I'll try. And of course, because Amy's the sweetest, and also just like for her writing songs, I imagine is like, well, I don't do anything easily. So I don't know that I can compare it to anything in my life.
Falling off a log. Yeah.
Like lifting a fork. I can do that. Yeah. I texted her and she's like, she was into it. I couldn't believe it. And she's just truly given me this extraordinary gift it's something I could have never, ever imagined.
I've known Amy for many years, and like, it's so funny to hold up the idea that some people get from her music that she's going to be a very serious and dour person. And when she's like one of the low-key funniest people I know.
Mm-hmm. She's so funny and also so good at roasting people.
Oh, yeah.
She's phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've probably interviewed her on various shows, you know, 4 or 5 times. And I remember one time thinking, I don't want to ask her about Voices Carry, the Till Tuesday right. song, because I know that comes from a time when she was in a really toxic relationship and it was abusive and it was a sore subject. And then I stopped and I thought about it. I'm like, I'm thinking of the video for Voices Carry where she was acting.
She's that good of an actor.
She's
good
in Big Lebowski. Yeah. And so it turns out, you know, no, it was written about somebody she knows. She's happy to talk about Voices Carry. It's not a problem, but it helps to get over the intimidation that way. Final question. Have you met anyone else named Bridger?
That's a good question. I don't think I am now like slowly becoming aware of other people named Bridger who are usually significantly younger than I am. But I don't think I've ever met another Bridger. I think they're actually in the movie business or something. I think there's like a DP or something named, or like a lighting designer or something named Bridger who I've never met, but somebody had told me that.
Okay. You're the senior Bridger. It's like Dustin Hoffman or Jason Robards. You're like the oldest with that name.
I hope so. I hope that I can claim that.
You're the Jason Robards of Bridgers. Bridger Weiniger, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I had a fantastic time, and it was so nice meeting you.
Myself perfectly clear when you're a guest in my home. You gotta come to me empty-handed. I said no gifts, your presence is present enough, and I already had too much stuff. So how do you dare disobey?
Because it is a podcast, you can find Bridger Weiniger's I Said No Gifts wherever you get your podcasts. Well, now, life can be stressful. It can be hard. It can be a lot. And you need to take care of yourself and your mind and body connection. And that's why we sometimes have a meditation moment here on the show. And as always, Laura House is here with us. She is the co-host of the Tiny Victories podcast. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
As always, there will be silence during these moments. Nothing is wrong with your speakers or your headphones. And if you're driving, please pull over safely. Don't just pull over. Don't just stop in the middle of a freeway.
No. Get to safety.
Get to safety. Find a parking spot where no one's going to hassle you. And let's take a meditation moment.
Yeah, we can even think of this as like a healthy quit. Let's just quit. Let's just, if you were the boss and you can say, hold my calls, that's what you get to do right now. So sit comfortably. That's the first thing. And close your eyes. Then just notice your breath, and you're going to have thoughts. Thoughts are invited. They are welcome to this event. But you're just kind of noticing your breath and letting your thoughts hang out. Then just let go. And slowly open your eyes.
Yeah.
And you just get that little reset with yourself. Like, we're pulled different directions, and this is
yes.
Like, oh, I'm right here. Oh, wait. Oh, this is me.
I've been here the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I didn't achieve total enlightenment, but I understand that's okay.
John. Yes, it is. It's okay. I think enlightenment is a big, maybe you're enlightened just because you choose to reconnect with yourself sometimes for 30 seconds or a minute. Maybe that's what enlightenment is.
Yeah. You don't need to see the vast interconnectedness of the universe. Just notice your breath a little. That's okay.
I got to tell you, don't expect an acid trip. It is very rarely do you have an experience in meditation that you're like, you guys... You guys, I gotta tell you, it's really just more of like simple, relax, let go. That was nice.
There aren't a lot of stories about, I remember this one time I was meditating.
Yeah, you're not gonna be the fun guy at the party with your awesome meditation story. I mean, every now and then, maybe some
depends
weird,
on the party, perhaps.
But yeah. What a terrible party.
Yeah.
Have you heard that chick talk about her meditation? Unreal.
Oh, let's get out of here. Let's go home. You can hear Laura on the Tiny Victories podcast here on Maximum Fun. You can check out more of her brilliant work at laurahouse.com. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, a very special holiday episode where drastically unqualified comedy people deliver psychiatric diagnoses of popular Christmas characters.
It's very hard to get out of that kind of a relationship, the one that children have with Santa.
But isn't that also a central theme of, like, every film? What he's most upset about is, like, people don't believe in me anymore. Come on, Billy. Get on the radio and tell them I'm real.
I think, if anything, Santa's, like, the best performance artist I've ever seen. He's Banksy.
If people support our show through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you donate already, you make Depression Mode happen, and we thank you. If you haven't donated, it's easy. Find a level that works for you. MaximumFun.org/join. Hey, I wrote a book. It's called The Hilarious World of Depression. It's a memoir. It's about me and mental health and life, and there are jokes in it. It makes a lovely gift. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do it now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. Please know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available, text the word HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We would love to hear from you. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search it up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hi, credits listeners. The Christmas character that I always think about the most is Jingle Horse from Jingle Bell Rock, because I don't know if that is a title or a name. Like, is any horse in the jingle position referred to as the Jingle Horse? Or was that horse born and named Jingle Horse and then just sort of always assumed that Christmas was the time to shine? How does Jingle Horse spend its summers? All that and more in my new 1,000-page origin story book, The History of Jingle Horse. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Melissa from Missouri, and I just want to say hey to all my fellow Preshies. And I want you to know that I love you and I appreciate you all.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.